Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keynote, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. It is Friday, June 2nd, 2023. It's been a publishing kind of week on Keynote this week. As so often, we began the week with a conversation with Hugh Howey. He's an interesting character. He self-published his first book, and now he's a huge hit. He has the Silo series that's just been made into an Apple Plus television or online spectacle. And he's very much a futurist thinking, as he discussed with me, that same-day AI movies are just around the corner. And he still believes, however, in books. And then yesterday, or the day before yesterday, we did a show with David Blake, the founder of Book Club, another way of rethinking books, of imagining how we're connecting, how readers and authors are connecting and rethinking the very nature of books. It's all about innovation. Book industry might be like the Brazilian economy, always on the horizon, always offering potential, never coming through. But my guest today is another innovator, Stephen Games. He's the editor of Book Launch, a very innovative quarterly summarizing news based in the UK. And he is also, he does podcasts, of course, and he's also the editor of a really intriguing new startup called Envelope Books, which is a way of combining the postcard and the book. And he's joining us from a sunny Muswell Hill. Stephen, tell me a little bit about your career. You're an unusual character. You've done a lot of different things. You've gone all the way from West Hampstead to Los Angeles and back to Muswell Hill, which is quite an achievement.
Well, I started out not knowing what I wanted to do, and I've pursued that as a sort of career ambition all the way through.
Seems to be a very distinctive thing of coming from Northwest London. You never quite know what you're going to do, and you make it up as you go along.
Yeah, but it's actually very important. It's important to me. I believe in groping one's way towards answers. I mean, for a large part of my career, I've been a designer, and I'm very well aware of the fact that other people in the design industry, maybe under more commercial pressure than I've been, are required to find a solution right from very off. You find your solution and then you sell it to the client and then you merely enact it. And I've never done that. I think that design solutions are something you need to live with. You need to chew them over. And very often the right answer will come to you. You don't have to construct artifice. There was a time when I used to be at the BBC. The BBC has a network called Radio 3, which is, or used to be, the intellectual network. It was sort of serious music and serious talk. And I was a documentary maker there. And in those days, before Margaret Thatcher and the need for everything to be financially accountable, Radio 3 would send me out to make documentaries. And the wonderful thing about their approach was I would have virtually a free hand to talk to people and look at subjects. And we very often didn't know what the documentaries that we were making were going to be until we came back. Very often go to the States. We go to the States twice a year for a couple of weeks. We'd meet as many people as we needed. We come back with our tape recordings, and then we'd listen to them in studio. And then we'd listen again, and then we'd listen again. And gradually a story emerged. And we would end up with the most remarkable things, because it was only when you listened back to someone maybe three times, maybe four times, that you tuned in to something they were saying that you hadn't noticed the first time. And it was that intense observation, which was really only possible in circumstances that are really fantastically generous and uncommercial.
Well,
it was only when
I
you could do that
you,
that you could come up with some sort of...
I introduced you, Stephen, as a futurist, and now you're going all nostalgic on me, going back to pre-Mrs. Thatcher UK, where everyone worked for the BBC and everyone had a blank check, and you went with a free hand groping to Los Angeles. I mean, I don't want to do that. It's boring. It's been said so many times before. And you know, it's utterly unrealistic, for better or worse. There is a bottom line. And you need to make money. And you can still be very creative and not work for the BBC, can't you?
That's not the... I'm not talking about how wonderful it was to work for the BBC. What I was talking about was the freedom to put one's agenda together after the process of observing.
But isn't that what that's what a creative person does, whether they're a writer, a painter, a musician, a jazz artist. I mean, that's the nature of creativity.
That's right. And that's what I feel I've had the ability to do for much of my life.
Oh, I see. So your life is a kind of version of that, of putting stuff together creatively.
Well, I wouldn't. If you're saying one needs to be commercial, yes. I mean, I don't suffer. I own my house. There's food on
the expensive Muswell Hill. You just told me that there's an opportunity for me to buy a £5 million house in Muswell Hill, which is quite a commercial opportunity.
Well, okay. So my point is that I think it's often important just to go with the flow and see what one can derive from it. I was never a publisher. I was a journalist. I worked for the BBC, I worked for The Guardian, I worked for the Independent newspaper, which came along in 1986. I was one of the first members of the staff of the Independent. But my experience of publishing is as a writer, not as a publisher. But about 5 years ago, I was able to do something I'd always wanted to do, which was start a magazine. And the magazine is called Book Launch. Yes, there it is, exactly. It's called Book Launch. And Book Launch filled a gap that hadn't been filled in the market, which was, instead of reviewing new books, as the New York Review of Books and the London Review of Books and the Times Literary Supplement do, a book launch carries extracts from new books, mostly, so that readers can see for themselves, read for themselves, how a writer writes and assess the writing on the basis of the writer's own words, rather than being handed an opinion about the writer.
It's kind of what Lit Hub does. I mean, Lit Hub is full of extracts from writers.
Yeah, well, we don't have that in the UK. So Book Launch is now
the largest. We have the internet, Stephen. Everyone can get everything these days.
Andrew, this is the point about this. The point about Book Launch was also to remind people of the joy of holding a book and turning its pages. And so the magazine, which you've just put up on screen, though it exists in a digital form, its most enjoyable, for me, its most enjoyable way of reading, of being read, is holding the printed copy. And we have a larger print run than any other books magazine in the UK.
That was one of the things we discussed with David Blake, is why and how the physical book has remained so viable, so resistant to change, and it's tactile quality, and for the fact that online reading still is problematic on lots of fronts.
I mean, I love it. I've discovered in the last couple of years that if you read in bed, reading on your iPhone backlit, you don't have to switch the light on, and it's a much simpler thing. It keeps track of how many pages you've read, how many pages you've still got to go. But the point about Book Launch was trying to pull itself out of what I thought when I started it 5 years ago was becoming a really unpleasant commercial market. But the only thing that publishers want is to sell through whatever else they might be doing online and to gather data. And you know what? As I said, we have a digital version of this fabulous magazine. And I don't gather data. I don't try to sell. It's not commercial. It's there as a resource for those people who can't get hold of the printed magazine.
There's certainly a market for that. It's like the quarterly Liberties, which we've done a number of interviews with contributors. People still love books. So tell me a little bit more about Book Launch. How many copies do you publish or sell or distribute?
Yeah, we've got a print run of 51,000.
Wow. And is that mostly people paying for it?
No. That's not our distribution model. Our distribution model is much more interesting. We go out free to every subscriber of the two main British political weekly magazines, The New Statesman and The Spectator. And we're quarterly. So every 3 months, you get a copy of Book Launch with your copy of either The Spectator or
So
the
your
Estate
business
Sale.
partner, so they're paying you as a value enhanced.
No,
no. Who's paying who for that? How are you making
paid,
your money?
We're paid by the publishers who take space in the magazine, and then we're paid by advertisers. On the back page of the magazine, you know, there is a page of advertising. So, you know, the model is a fairly conventional one. We sell you space, you give us money. But what I'm able to provide is a readership of 50,000 compared with, say, the London Review of Books, which has a global print run of 89,000, only 41,000 in the UK. The Literary Review, which is just touching 40,000, and the poor old Times Literary Supplement, which has managed to climb up from 21,000, 22,000 before COVID, up to about 25 or 26 now.
I mean, these are still more traditional publications. You're saying
yes,
that publishers pay you to be in the quarterly. So how do you determine who gets in and who doesn't? Who pays the most?
I have to like the book.
Okay.
Well, I have to like the book,
like the
I have
book,
to think
it doesn't matter what people pay you.
No, that's not the issue. The issue is to pitch the magazine at the sort of level that I want it to be pitched at. And, you know, some people come along and offer and want to buy space. And I say, well, I really don't think that your book would bed down well.
Stephen, isn't there? I mean, you're comparing yourself with the London Review books. People choose to subscribe. Yours just goes out because whoever's subscribing to the New Statesman gets it on a quarterly basis. Yeah. Anyway, so let's move on. That's an interesting model. Let's move on to envelope books. Tell me a little bit more about that.
It's a great model because it provides those who do advertise it with us with an absolutely dead cert audience of people who really like reading and, you know, and are aware of the world.
You mean this is Book Launch or Envelope Books?
I'm talking about Book Launch, and I'm talking about our being able to reach the subscribers of the New Statesman and the Spectator.
But as a subscriber of something, you subscribe to the Spectator, not to Book Launch. So do people really want it?
That's right.
I assume they do. Otherwise,
well, I have it works. It's working. It works for me, and it also works for Envelope Books because what started happening, this is how Envelope Books came along, is that readers would contact Book Launch and say, I have a book, I don't know how to get published. I've done everything I can think of doing to get published. I can't find an agent and I can't find a publisher. Can you advise? And after about a year of trying to help, because I like to be helpful, I thought, well, you know what? We can do this ourselves. And I just have a constant throughput of offers from our readers, so I know that it's working.
So as a kind of publisher, I guess myself, I get pitched all the time, people with new books, just like you did.
Mm.
And one criteria I use is I'm always a little ambivalent about people who self-publish with what I would call vanity presses. Are you a vanity press? How do you decide what gets published on Envelope Books or not?
No, Envelope Books is a conventional publisher. We try to get onto the bookshelves of shops. Here is an example. I don't know whether you can see that. If you flash back to me, I'm holding, right. So here's Envelope Books. All the covers look like envelopes, but inside they're, you know, conventional books. And this you can find on the shelf of your bookshop.
And that Africa book if I had to choose the one that I would buy or read, from browsing through Postmark Africa, it's the one I also flashed up. So it's interesting.
Yeah, it's great. Well, that was our very first book, and that was written by, that's the collected journalism on Africa by a former Africa editor of the Financial Times, lovely chap called Michael Holman, who also actually had one of the first operations, he's got Parkinson's, had one of the first deep brain electrode operations to deal with his Parkinson's. So those are all kind of conventional books. What we also do any number of people come to us to say, I want to write my memoirs, I want to make them available, I want to give them to the family and friends and so on. So you think, right, well, this is a book in that case, which is going to have a readership of 50, 100, 200. And for them, we have another imprint called Postcard Books.
Yeah.
And that those books, I mean, again, you can buy, we print physical copies, but those will go up on Amazon, and anybody who wants to buy those.
Yeah, and as you say on your postcard book section of your website, what is a short book but a postcard from a writer to a reader? And postcards, of course, are again a sort of nostalgia. So that is vanity publishing, essentially. People are paying so you to put the stuff together to distribute to their friends.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to knock it as bad.
Well,
as
I'm not knocking it. It's just people who want to have their stuff out there. That's not a bad thing.
Yes. Yeah, and they deserve to, and they deserve to be helped, because the publishing industry is so very competitive and unpleasant. And if there's something that we can do to help someone get their book out and they feel good about it, they've got 100 copies that they can sell in Amazon, that pleases me a lot. What we do, unlike, and there are a lot of, and this is another reason why I set up Envelope, there are a lot of cutthroat publishers out there who will take a lot of money from innocents who are too naive to know how they're being ripped off, and they will not give them a good product. They won't copy edit properly. They won't edit properly. They won't edit at all.
Okay, so I take your point. I mean, everyone claims to be honest. What do you do? I mean, how much does it cost, and what's the process? If I came to you wanting a postcard book.
The process, the most important process is, one, we actually read the book. Two, sorry, I don't mean to number it, that sounds ridiculous. We read the book, then we get into a conversation with the writer about what they want to do and how well they have expressed themselves. And if they express themselves well, like this one here, I mean, this is Jane Reed's book, Nell Nora Jane. It's about her childhood up to the outbreak of the Second World War. She writes, she is elderly, and she comes from a time when everyone wrote perfectly because they were taught to write well at school. So there weren't many problems with her. Nonetheless, you have to go through the copy editing process, and then you typeset, and then you lay out the book on the page, and then you proofread to make sure that no glitches have come up, and you design the cover and you print out the book. Now that is, you would have thought, was the bottom line default process that most publishers abide by. It isn't. It isn't.
Is it because publishing, you're knocking the traditional publishing industry. Is it because...
No, I'm not knocking
greedy? The... Well, I'm you not, are. You're saying that they don't get what you give.
I'm not knocking the traditional publishing industry. I'm knocking exactly what you're talking about, that cadre of publishers who came along to satisfy the vanity publishing market.
The The self-publishing industry.
Yeah, and you know what? When they publish a book, it ends up looking like a student thesis. It invariably comes out in 12-point Times New Roman, spaced with line spacing between the paragraphs. Everything about it says this has been self-published. And it's a disgrace how many companies like that have got rich from
Are there really particular ones in mind? It's Scribner. You hear a lot of the names. Are there ones
Of course, I'm not going to put myself on the line by naming any of the firms that do that. But I have people coming to me all the time saying, I have been offered this service, or I have already paid for thousands and thousands of pounds from the service, and I'm really sorry. Now I've got another book.
What would it, I mean, for our viewers and listeners who are interested maybe in self-publishing, whatever you want to call it, with postmark books, what does it cost?
Well, typically between £2,000 and £2,500. So what would that be in dollars?
Well, depending on the exchange rate, about $3,000-$3,500. And what would you get?
Not as much as three and a half. I would say up to three.
Okay. Well, what would you get for that? Would you get a number of copies?
No, what you get is the whole production process. The copies cost nothing. I mean, the copy is buying copy from Amazon. That's not the point. The point is paying for copy editors who can charge anything from £15 to £30 per 1,000 words, and proofreaders who charge anything from £10 to £15 a 1,000 words, and your beautiful cover design. Here is a diplomat we did this cover for, and all of this clever stuff on the back. So, and that is a very competitive rate, you know, for the level of editorial intervention which you get there, and for the quality of product at the end, It's a staggering.
So what you're doing then is essentially bringing together the quality of traditional publishing with enabling people who, for one reason or other, can't get published by mainstream publishing with the same tools, the same quality editing and printing and design.
We're bringing conscientiousness, yes, to that process. And I really think it's important. And
how
it's
many of these postmarked books are you doing a year?
Four, five, six, something like that. We've only been in business for 2 years, Andrew.
So it's really quite a time-consuming process.
Yeah, it's a very time-consuming process.
And in terms of envelope books, but the core is still as a more of a traditional publisher, finding quality work.
Yes. Yes.
One reason or other hasn't been published elsewhere.
Yes. And there's, I mean, there's good word of mouth also. You know, someone brings a book out and they say to their friend, you know, Stephen Games Envelope Books will do a good job. Try him out. So I've got stuff coming all the time.
Let's go back. I began talking about Hugh Howey. He had great self-confidence in self-publishing his first book, and he's gone on to sell millions of copies, make millions of dollars. What advice would you give a young writer who has confidence in their work? Should they go the Hugh Howey envelope books or postcard books self-publishing route and then build commercial relationships with more traditional publishers, as Howey has done?
Well, it's hard for me to know. I mean, if you can get yourself a contract with one of the Penguin Random House publishers, that will stand you in very good stead for a very simple reason. They are very well established. They have international coverage. The name is well known. I mean, Penguin owns, I think, 273 different imprints. So they have a sophisticated distribution system. They have their rights system set up. So, of course, that's going to be very clever if you can get in. The difference between that and us, I mean, and we have an immediate problem. We've only been publishing books for 2 years. We're very, very new. We've only been available in the United States since March of this year. We're only going to be available around the world from next week because we've just signed a big deal with a world sales team and distributor. So we're very new. And that means we're working at a huge handicap because we are fighting what is effectively a cartel, a monopoly. Now, if you were the books editor on the Los Angeles Times or the New York Times or the Washington Post or whatever, you've got your friends, you've got your established network, you know the contacts from the marketing division of Simon & Schuster or Penguin or Random House or whoever it is. You know those people. And we come along knocking and say, look, we've got this wonderful new book of short stories by Yanina David. Could you review them? And half the time, we don't get any.
Does it even matter, though? I mean, the business is changing so dramatically. Whether or not you get reviews in the New York Times or the Los Angeles Times, I mean, the big hits now are often self-published, distributed online. Critical infrastructure matter anymore, Stephen?
It's great for PR. I mean, in a few months' time, we're going to be republishing a book by Michael Goldfarb. I don't know whether you know the name.
Yeah, I do know. I mean, I don't know him personally. I know his work.
Right. So he was a reporter with National Public Radio for many years and covered the second Gulf War. His contact in Iraq was an Iraqi Kurd, a man called Ahmad Shalkat. And Ahmad was a publisher. He was a newspaper publisher and an intellectual. And he helped to show Michael around while he was covering the Second Gulf War. He survived, and then the Americans sort of pulled out. And within 6 months, Ahmad had been assassinated. Mm. The book is called Ahmad's War, Ahmad's Peace. He survived the war, he didn't survive the peace. And we'll bring that book out. And that came out originally, I think, in 2005, 2006. And the first page is just a list of the great and the good in conventional newspapers and magazines saying what a great book this is. it's lovely to be able to open that, and it gives the reader a lot of reassurance when they flick through the pages of a book in a bookshop and they see that. You know, if I say our book has been seen 25,000 times or whatever on TikTok, you know, it's important, and it's the way we're going, but it doesn't have the same cachet.
Stephen, I found an interesting interview with you about five things you need to know to become a great author. I don't want five things. Just give me one thing. And what exactly is a great author?
I don't know. I mean, I said in that interview, there are people who've set out to be great authors, and I think it doesn't work. And rather in the same way as I say, you know, let life take its course, flow, go with the flow. We'll find out in 50 years who the great authors were. Just do what you do as well as you can do it. And you will be helped by, I mean, one of the great books that I'd like to publish is about the editing process. It's the untold story of publishing, isn't it? We don't know who comes to a publishing house and then gets shaped, reshaped, manipulated, helped by an editor. But it's a very, very important process. I myself am a very, very interventionist editor. And texts come to me and I say, that can't go out. That is not well phrased, or you haven't thought the thought through, or you're not allowing the thought to express itself properly. And we work on a text and we stretch it. And I always feel that my sort of book publishing, it's a bit like Hollywood in the sense that the writer produces the thing, and then there's the production team, and they work, you know, the script writing, the editorial team, and they tear a book apart. They tear a script apart and they work out what's best about it, what will work and what needs to be dropped. And it's a very, very painful process for writers. Screenwriters are brought up to expect it. They know that they're going to have their script shredded. I'm not saying that we always shred, but I mean, we grant ourselves that freedom because it's probably going to do a writer good if the writer hasn't quite come in at the right level.
Right. A couple of final questions, Stephen, and you're on the front lines of this stuff. We talked to Howie about same day AI movies. AI is flavor of the month, of the year, of the decade out here in Silicon Valley. How do you see AI changing the editorial process? Are you a skeptic of some of these more dramatic and sometimes dark visions of how AI is going to change everything, make all of us, particularly writers and editors, redundant?
I'm worried about the next generation, the young kids who will only have grown up with it, because I don't know that they'll have the right questions to ask. When I'm bored, I have conversations with ChatGPT, and they're extremely instructive, and I'm slowly learning the things that ChatGPT can't do. Number one, it can't write poetry. It can vaguely rhyme, but it has absolutely no idea how to scan. But that's partly because most people who write rubbish poetry these days don't know how to scan either, even when they try. The other thing that ChatGPT can't do is admit that it doesn't know something. And I've been asking it questions over the last week. I say, tell me a funny but true story about Martin Amis after he died. And ChatGPT will tell me a funny story about Martin Amis, about something that he said at a literary conference. And if you then go back and say, is that a true story? It will say, no, actually, I fabricated it. And I said, but I asked you to tell me a true story. And it says, oh, I'm terribly sorry. I must apologize. I hadn't quite realized. And then you ask the same question again, and it does the same thing again. So ChatGPT is dishonest, does not know the difference between truth and falsehood, and thinks that an apology is a simple way out. It's absolutely
sounds like eye-opening. Most people, though, Stephen, aren't we all a bit like that? Most of us are very bad at apologizing or acknowledging that, well, we might apologize, but acknowledging we were wrong. Maybe that's a reflection of the AI's founders. Well, certainly in America, people struggle to acknowledge they're wrong.
Okay, well, I just expected more of the cleverest brain that's ever been invented.
You're disappointed then with ChatGPT. Stephen Marsh, who's been on the show as an AI expert, as a writer, very credible writer too, the Canadian-based novelist, he thinks that the future is partnering. Writers and editors partnering with AI. Do you think that's true? Do you think you'll be able to leverage these platforms, these systems, these algorithms at Envelope Books?
I already do to some extent. I mean, if I'm writing something, I always now ask ChatGPT a question to see what answer it gives, and then if I think there's something useful that it said that I haven't added, absorbed, I take it in. But now I've discovered that I have to be much more rigorous with ChatGPT's answers than I had realized to begin with, because it is likely, and I found this now time and time again, it is likely to tell me something that it thinks I want to know, irrespective of whether that's true.
Well, let's end, Stephen, with you telling me something that you think I don't want to know. Be un-ChatGPT-like. Remind everyone of the value of human beings, smart human beings like Stephen Games.
Well, I don't know. I'm not the most competitive person here, like I say. I didn't come to this world to be fantastically commercial. I do think that it's important to provide a service for people who just can't get through the barriers of agency and publishing. And you know, if there's something we can do, and we end up by producing a book that makes the audience say, "Wow, glad this exists," well, then I'm very, very happy.
Maybe, Stephen, we should agree. We should just get rid of agents. They're the biggest problem of all, aren't they? The gatekeepers.
The gatekeepers, but they're worse than gatekeepers. You know, you go to an agent's website, and it says, "Please don't ask. You know, we're full. We're not accepting entries. We're not accepting submissions. Just go away." And Envelope Books, you know, I say to people, "We'll give you I'll give you a first answer in 24 hours." You know, there's a line of communication.
The envelope is open with Envelope Books.
The envelope is open. That's what we're pushing.